I'll now request Dr. Qureshi. He needs no introduction. We all know he was the 17th Chief Election Commissioner of India, the world's largest democracy. And he has also figured in the Indian Express list of the 100 most powerful Indians of 2011 and 2012. He has authored a monumental book, An Undocumented Wonder, The Making of the Great Indian Election, and has also compiled and edited the book, The Great March of Democracy, 7 Decades of India's Elections, among other books. Sir, with that very brief introduction, I would invite you to kindly share your views.
Yeah, thank you, General Verma. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for taking up this very important topic for a webinar. I was hearing the two speakers before me. They spoke very well, added to my knowledge. I'll only say 2-3 things. Let me also put on my clock so that I'm within 30 minutes. You know, this issue has been hanging fire for good 30, 40 years, and there seems to be no solution. We are going on and on, more or less saying the same thing, almost moving in circles, which is a pity. Secondly, what you pointed out in your opening remarks, the problem is, despite all the debate and all the concern which everybody expresses, including the political parties, which is amounts only lip service, the problem has only been increasing. You read out statistics from 2004 election to 2024 election. It has gone up more than 100%, 125% or so. So the problem is on the increase. And to that, for this reason, any solution coming from parliament is becoming a remoter and remoter possibility, because these are the guys whose fate we are going to decide, and they are the guys who are going to make the law, so, which is an unfortunate thing. Then we have been demanding that the election commission's proposal has been that don't wait for the conviction, although currently there is a debate that after somebody is convicted, will he or she be banned for life? Which, of course, I oppose, because life sentence and life punishment for offenses like this may be too much. But already the law which exists, that you serve 2-year sentence, 3-year sentence, and after that 6 years of disqualification. So 9-10 years is enough for a politician to be out of sight and lose his or her relevance. So that is punishment enough, and I'm against life imprisonment. That is, you know, too much, asking for too much. When we can't get this, we're asking for 100 times more. That's not going to work. Thirdly, the, you know, vulnerability, the issue over integrity, that is something which I have also been talking about. And in my book, which you mentioned, into Undocumented Wonder 2014, I had mentioned that if only political parties try this principled stand that we will not give tickets to a criminally tainted candidate, people will rush to vote for such a party. I was proved wrong. I'm very sad and sorry to, that this turned out to be a misjudgment. I thought the people will support this stand. And at one stage, I remember in 2012 and 13, Mayawati had asserted that she's not going to give tickets to a criminal candidate, but she did. So, and I had in my book, that was the context in which I appreciated that this is a very good stand and is likely to win people's support. He did not. In fact, I remember reading a paper, I think one of the writers was Mr. Ishwaran from Bangalore, and one more person I have forgotten, but I'll try, or maybe General Verma can remind me, where a detailed study showed that the criminals and the rich people have greater chance of winning election. Their vulnerability is higher. And so even a research study has proved that. Therefore, I think, Mr. Gogoi, the anecdote of his own party's experiment when they tried to follow this principle and lost that seat. Now, for a political party, winning every seat at whatever cost is absolutely important. We should realize that. Because if they lose and sit at home, what use is that principled politics? So, first thing is for them to win election. So, therefore, this debate between winnability and integrity is almost clinched as far as I'm concerned. Now, keep talking about judiciary's role. There are two possibilities. One is they set up special courts only for this purpose. The other is ask the existing courts to expedite the cases of the politician. The argument against the latter thing is that how can the court give preference to a particular kind of cases? Although I mentioned in some of my articles, you know, it's not true. The existing courts have been prioritizing. They can give priority as a matter of policy. But okay, even then, the other alternative of setting up a special court, well, Supreme Court has finally done it in 2018 when they asked all the state governments to set up a special court. And I think 11, how many states, I'll just tell you the figure, that the 11 states or 12 states have set up these courts. But that is perhaps not enough, and the performance of different states varies. So we have to do something about that. In 2021, Supreme Court reviewed the performance of these special courts and expressed its dissatisfaction because the number of cases disposed was not as much as was expected, and so on. So, but we know very little about this. The fact that the special courts were set up, Supreme Court did monitor, expressed the dissatisfaction. I'm not seeing it in the media. I just researched there, and in that I found out. I would recommend to General Verma and ADR, or PUCL and other civil society organization, to why not kindly do a quick study. Just collect the data. It's not a very complex study. What has been the performance, what has been the experience of these special courts and how to take it forward. Then passing it on to the voters again makes me very uncomfortable, but the fact is that the voters can be brainwashed. And one example is that after COVID, when people walked 1,000 kilometers, lost jobs, hundreds of them were killed, after demonetization, when hundreds of people were died standing in the queue, immediately after that, when there were elections, the government which inflicted these atrocities won hands down. Now, it was surprising. And my cynical analysis is if you ask a voter in Bihar, do you want a job or do you want the head of a particular community's person? Their jawab will be, ki, no, no, job to milti rahegi, baad mein mil jayegi, lekin hume falan ka sar la do, aur ye to falan leader hi kar sakta hai. You know, this kind of response, and this is what is getting reflected in the election. In such a situation, don't vote for a criminal candidate. Do you think this is going to have any impact? Zero. And as was mentioned by the previous year, particularly Kavita Srivastava, that wrestling federation chief, despite the molestation of women, and not one, two, three, but so many, and all champions, he continued to enjoy the protection of the political party, gave ticket to his son, and he won hands down. Again, so what can we expect from the people? Therefore, again, it sounds cynical, but then just as politicians brainwash the voters, civil society and the media and all of us together also must have a counter program to, I would not use the word brainwash, but to also to educate them to think correctly and behave appropriately. Then, finally, you know, I would like to mention one dilemma which we have been facing, that when we say election commission suggests that people against whom serious cases of criminal nature are pending, during pendency they should be debarred from voting. There has been a great debate on it. There a law commission considered the issue. It has gone to the Supreme Court. They all say that the law of the land is you are the presumption of innocence. You are innocent till proved guilty. Fair enough. But I have been asking a counter question in even in conferences when judges of the Supreme Court and High Court, they were sitting, very senior jurists were sitting, and I asked them the question and there was complete silence. Till today, I have not got a reply. And what is my question? Okay, look, you all talk of presumption of innocence and we know it very well. But in Indian jails today, there are 4,31,000 prisoners, of which 71% are under trial. That means not yet convicted. That means innocent. But although they're innocent by your own definition, but you have taken away not one or two, but four fundamental rights. Right to liberty, freedom of movement, freedom of occupation, right to dignity. Four fundamental rights you have taken away of 3,70,000 innocent people. What is this? Explain to us the law. If you can take away four fundamental rights of an innocent person, what is the big deal about taking away his right to contest? It's not even a fundamental right. It is a statutory right, which can be suspended for some time. And if it is suspended, you will notice that the same people will rush to the court and get the best lawyers to get their cases expedited rather than delayed. For 20 years, the case goes on and the rapist continues to rape. So what is this? Therefore, I'm surprised that despite our very mature democracy, very mature judiciary, they have not been able to find a solution. And the impact is for everybody to see. So I think these are some of the remarks I have. The role of the ADR comes into the picture again. You only can play the role. The fact that we have such seminars, the fact that media mentions how many criminal MLAs, MPs have criminal cases, it's only because you are pointing it out. The fact that even the courts have said that every political party should advertise how many criminal candidates they put up and what are the cases. The fact that candidates themselves are asked to publish along with their promotional advertisement that these are the cases pending against me. All that is a very positive outcome of this debate, of which ADR, of course, is the institution which is playing the key role, for which you deserve compliment, General Verma. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Qureshi. If you would be here for some time, sir, can we take the questions at the end?
Yes, of course.
So now I'll invite Mr. Ruben. Mr. Ruben is a lawyer, technologist, socio-political activist, and the National Joint Secretary of Aam Aadmi Party. He is the spokesperson, working president of the Mumbai unit. He is also the co-founder and director of Khana Chahiye Foundation, which works towards solving for hunger in urban India through policy advocacy, use of smart technology, and community mobilization. In 2009, as part of his Jago Re campaign, Ruben registered lakhs of first-time voters in Mumbai. In 2011, he was at the forefront of the India Against Corruption movement. And he also launched the Zero Tolerance Campaign, ZTC, successfully, amending the anti-sexual harassment law in Maharashtra, making it stronger and pro-women. He's a digital evangelist. He was awarded the prestigious title of Mumbai Heroes by Mumbai Mirror for contributing to the highest ever voter turnout in Mumbai in 2017 by partnering with various state election commissions. He is presently practicing law as a counsel at Samya Partners at Mumbai High Court. Over to you, Ruben.
Thank you so much, General Anil Verma. It's an absolute honor to be invited to this esteemed panel with the likes of Qureshi Saab and Prashant Ji, whom all of us look forward to. So thank you so much for this. And I'd like to congratulate you for actually taking such a complex and a difficult topic, which doesn't really have a straight answer. And it's and we require more of these discussions. First, I think I'll just make my opening remarks and then I'll try and answer those questions of the webinar to be specific. And then maybe we can open the floor to questions and answers. First is, why do criminals enter politics? Criminals enter politics because our political system gives them ample opportunity to subvert the criminal justice system. We do not have independence of investigation. We know as soon as an accused jumps to a particular political party, we have the cases against them going slow. We have, in some cases, summaries being filed against them as though there is no case that is being made out by the prosecution itself. So all of this happens because this is a systemic problem, and this is a very deep problem. And when we speak about this issue, we shouldn't look at it in terms of a binary, whether it is just a criminal or a non-criminal, or for that matter, the way politics looks at it, are you with a political party or you are not with a political party? So let's look at politics and then come to the issue at hand. In Parliament, dissent is equal to defection. There is no place for nuance. As soon as there is a whip, and if somebody votes against the whip, the person is, there is anti-defection proceedings which are initiated against that person. So when you have such an arrangement, you don't have politicians who are committed to party ideology. You have politicians who are committed to one particular person or the party without any commitment to a party, political ideology. And if you have such people coming into politics, then what can we really expect of them? Now, let me speak about this entire criminal and non-criminal debate. I think there has to be a distinction that is being made in terms of a person who is accused of a crime and a person who's actually undergoing a trial and a person who's actually convicted. Let me give an example. I was protesting in Mumbai against the arrest of my leader, Arvind Kejriwal, with what is clearly weaponization of the criminal justice system in terms of political vendetta. And we protested, we burnt an effigy of Prime Minister Modi. And just for that act of protest, I have a case of arson and rioting against me and my fellow colleagues. And it's very easy for the criminal elements to file a case against the non-criminal elements to make them look criminal. So the way I look at it is, when we see the kind of discourse that we have in politics, I think people just don't have a choice. And the reason why people vote in a particular way is because we have the first past the post system. And in the first past the post system, nobody wants to vote in such a way that their vote is wasted. So irrespective of whatever choices are given to them, they just go with that because they don't want to vote for a candidate who is losing. Having said that, there is a lot of discussion about winnability. And while winnability is important, yes, as a political party, you are essentially pursuing power. What is really missing is this representability. Is this person good enough to actually represent me or represent my aspirations in Parliament or in the House or anywhere where the person is essentially elected? And the problem is far more complex because even if you, let's say, disqualify a particular person, like in the case of Brij Bhushan, you actually had a proxy in case of his son. And this is a multiple-headed hydra, which really needs reform. But of course, more than anything else is political pressure. So there was a discussion in where Mr. Gogoi, prior to me, said that there is public pressure. There is public pressure. It's not that there is no public pressure. There is enough and more public pressure. What is needed is for the culture to be set at the top. What is needed for political parties to actually give tickets to decent people. But of late, what we've been seeing is this extremely dangerous trend where, as Kavita ji rightly mentioned, that the criminal justice system is being weaponized specifically against the opposition. We see cases of vendetta. We see how it is only systematically that the opposition is targeted in state after state. It's part of the BJP's playbook. It is that teachered uchalo aur uchalo kuch to chipkega. And it is that narrative management that, oh, okay, there is a case which is basically against you, and hence you are as criminal as somebody who is convicted. So that distinction has to be made, and that distinction is extremely critical. Having said that, I will now go on to specific questions which were part of the webinar. First is, who will bail the cat, executive or the judiciary? It has to be the judiciary in this case, because the executive is just an extension of the legislature. There is no distinction between the executive and the legislature. It is sad, but it's true. You expect your elected representative to actually be the executive in your area. It's not that the elected representative just focuses on making laws. And obviously, we all know that most political parties asking them to do something like this is basically trying to get turkeys to vote for Christmas. So it has to be the judiciary, because the judiciary has taken the vow of upholding the constitution. Second, does it impact good governance? I think it certainly does impact good governance. When you basically have such criminal elements in office, all that they are interested in is not issues of public importance. It's not issues of governance. It's essentially self-serving. And of course, governance suffers. Governance as a good of public service delivery also suffers. Should there be a lifetime ban or disqualification? I think the very fact that somebody is penalized, and if a person is disqualified, I think a person should be disqualified for a particular period of time. And there can be consensus in the parties, right, with regards to whom should the tickets be given. But I think this lifetime ban is something which is without precedent anywhere in the world. And I think the disqualification, and as long as a person has served the sentence, especially in a reformative system like ours, we should go with disqualification. With regards to reforms, will reforms actually work? I think any reform is dependent on the weakest link in its reforms. If we actually look at the lower judiciary, it is an absolute shambles. As a practicing lawyer, I'd like to stick my neck out and say, and sadly say, that the pursuit of justice is a luxury in our country. And given the painstakingly slow process and the quality of justice that we have in the country, there is much more that needs to be done. Because right now what we're seeing is actually institutional erosion. Because let's say that if you actually had such a pronouncement from an institution which was absolutely beyond reproach, it would have been great. But with regards to what happened with Justice Verma and the notes and the cover-up and what is happening and what is not happening, has also resulted into a lot of erosion of institutional integrity. So having said that, I think there is a way forward, and the way forward has to be that political parties set this culture. And whoever has said that politics is the last resort of the scoundrel has done the greatest disservice to humanity. Politics is for the brightest, and politics is the most efficient tool to bring about social change. And having said that, it is about this new political culture, where criminal elements are not supported. And I think young people in the country, who make up over 70% of our population and our electorate, at least for the next 20 years, will be fairly young. I think that group of constituency, that young people, will essentially put this pressure on the demand side so that we actually don't need a supply of criminal politicians. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ruben. We'll take the questions in the end.
Sure.
I'll now invite Mr. Prashant Bhushan, who's been waiting patiently. Thank you for joining, sir. And we all know that he's one of India's most well-known and respected public interest lawyers and a human rights activist. He has been practicing in the Supreme Court of India and Delhi High Court for the last 3 decades. He was a member of the faction of the India Against Corruption movement known as Team Anna, which supported Anna Hazare's campaign for the implementation of the Jan Lokpal Bill. He is the author of The Case That Shook India and Bofors, The Selling of a Nation. He is associated with various organizations, including the Center for Public Interest Litigation, CPIL, the People's Union for Civil Liberties, PUCL, and Transparency International India. He is also the convener of Judicial Accountability and Judicial Reform Campaign Working Committee. He has taken about more than 500 pro bono cases that deal with environment, corruption, electoral reforms, etc., and much more. With that brief introduction, I would like to now invite Mr. Prashant Bhushan to share his views.
Thank you, General Verma. While this is certainly a very important issue for us to think about as to why there are so many criminals in politics and who are successful in politics. As Mr. Qureshi told you, that there is one proposal that has been made from time to time to deal with this problem, which is that those who have been charge sheeted, or those against whom charges have been framed, those politicians, they should not be allowed to contest, because we can't wait till their conviction, which often happens after many, many years, because they can delay the proceedings. The problem with that suggestion is the following. You see, charge sheet is in the hands of the investigating agency, which we have seen is in the hands of the government, notwithstanding the Supreme Court's orders on police reforms and reforms of the CBI, etc. Despite that, we are seeing that these investigating agencies act largely at the behest of the ruling party who control them. And it is easy for them to just frame any opposition politician, if they want to, falsely frame them. And if they frame them falsely, for example, I'll just give you an example. Let's say that an opposition politician is accused of rape. And they get somebody, a victim, to say that, yes, he raped me. Now, obviously, if a police files a charge sheet on the basis of the allegation of that victim, then charges, the court will have no option but to frame charges and hold a trial. So that would mean that till the trial is completed, this politician would be barred from contesting the elections. So therefore, such a provision can lead to a lot of misuse by the ruling party against opposition politicians who may be wrongly framed, and courts have no option but to frame charges, because at the stage of framing charges, they cannot judge whether the statement or the allegation made by the victim is true or false. And therefore, that was found to be quite dangerous. And therefore, it was felt that the present provision, which says that you are barred only after conviction, if there is no stay of your conviction, that provision should continue. Now, you see, it is true that there is a big problem because politicians are able to, important, powerful politicians are able to delay their trial for a long time and thereby prevent their conviction. Very often in a delayed trial, witnesses also turn hostile. They are able to influence the witnesses, etc. This is primarily a failure of our criminal justice system. Sometimes they are able to delay the investigation itself for a long time. Sometimes even FIRs are not registered and so on. So, unfortunately, to some extent, this is the result of the non-implementation of the police reforms which were ordered by the Supreme Court. One of the reforms was to separate the investigation wing of the police from the law and order wing, because the basis was that law and order is an executive function. Government can be in charge of that. But so far as investigation is concerned, that is part of the criminal administration of justice. And therefore, that need not be under government control, or certainly can be much more insulated from government. And unfortunately, none of that has happened. There was a direction regarding the manner in which DGP should be appointed, that UPSC should select three names and the government only has an option to select one of those three, etc. But even that has not happened, and we are seeing that even UPSC's independence has collapsed in recent times. And therefore, Mr. Prakash Singh has made another application for modifying this and having a selection committee for DGPs, just like they have for the CBI director, that is Prime Minister, Leader of Opposition and the Chief Justice of India. So there is a problem at the level of investigation. There is also a problem at the level of trials. So in that, the reason is that the whole judicial system has collapsed and trials take interminably long. Sometimes they take 20 years, 25 years, etc. And therefore, for that, we need to reform the criminal justice system. In fact, just yesterday, there was a case in the Supreme Court which was filed by us in 2004 by one lawyer called Mr. V.K. Ohri. And the prayer in that petition was that the investigations and the trials of powerful people, and powerful people needed to be defined, and we had attempted a definition of powerful people, who are key players in our democracy, should be fast-tracked and should be supervised or overseen by the high courts, etc. That both the investigation as well as the trial of influential people should be fast-tracked and overseen by the high court. This is the suggestion. That case has been still pending. It is adjourned. And of course, one option is then the court asked the law commission to examine this proposal, etc. The law commission gave a very detailed report. And the law commission's report was largely for strengthening the entire administration of justice, of criminal justice, and for speeding up all trials, not just of influential people. Now, judicial reforms is an area which has been pending consideration or really hanging fire for a very, very long time. For many years, for the last 40 years, law commissions have made repeated recommendations that we need to increase the number of judges. Our number of judges is very low. But far from doing that, we have not even succeeded in filling up the vacancies that are of the posts which are already there, of judges both in the lower courts as well as in the high courts. There is roughly 30% vacancy in the lower courts as well as in the high courts on an average across the country. So law commission has been saying we need to increase the strength of judges fivefold. Far from fivefold, we are still functioning at only 66 or 70% of the strength of the existing judiciary. Then we made a Gram Nyayalaya Act in 2010 or so. And till now, we have not implemented that Gram Nyayalaya Act. The idea was that at least ordinary petty cases could be disposed of in these Gram Nyayalayas, which would be like courts, but more informal courts, which would be set up at the sub-tehsil level. Today, we have civil courts only at the tehsil level. Unfortunately, even that has not been implemented. So we are seeing across the board a failure on the part of the political class and also on the part of the judiciary in implementing judicial reforms which would bring about a quicker administration of justice. And today, after this Justice Yashwant Verma affair, the whole attempt of the government only is to somehow seize control, use this case to seize control of the power of appointments from the judiciary. Of course, there are many problems with the present system, collegium system of selection. There is no transparency, there is a lot of nepotism, etc. But in the collegium, and those problems would remain even if the executive were to get some more control of the judiciary. But at least in the collegium system, somewhat more independent judges are being selected as compared to the system where the government has more say in the manner of appointment of judges. What this government has been doing for the last 10 years is it has been stopping the appointment of independent and competent judges by just sitting on the recommendations of such judges by the collegium and only issuing notifications for the appointment of those judges that this government likes. And then they are able to sometimes strike a compromise with the collegium and they say, okay, all right, you appoint two of our people, then we will appoint one of the people that you have recommended, etc. So it has become a serious problem. But we need to implement across the board judicial reforms for a quicker decision in all these cases and therefore quicker conviction of the of those who have actually committed crimes and quicker acquittal of those who are innocent. Because even that is important, that if somebody is innocent, he should be quickly acquitted and that case should not remain hanging for so long. Then we have this phenomenon which Mr. Qureshi also mentioned, that unfortunately, despite the people knowing with this ADR judgment, the criminal records of the candidates come to be known. But yet, criminals are often elected. Criminals are often elected by the people. Why is that happening? That is happening because our whole system of electoral politics and elections has become a game of money. And it has become a game of money because we have first passed the post at two levels. When we select the candidate at the constituency level, the candidate who gets the highest votes becomes the sole representative of the constituency, even if he gets only 25-30% of the vote. If nobody else has got more votes than him, he becomes the sole representative. Then when the government is formed, the party which gets a majority or the coalition which gets a majority becomes the sole government, and the opposition, even if it has 49% of the seats, counts for nothing in running the government. Therefore, when people go to vote, they are not necessarily voting for their best candidate or party if they feel that their best candidate or party has no hope of winning. Now, how do they assess who has some hope of winning or has no hope of winning? That assessment is made on the basis of visibility of the candidates and the parties. And visibility is essentially a function of money. If you have money, you can buy advertisements in newspapers, TV, you can put hoardings, you can have your paid workers going around with your posters, handbills, etc. You can even organize large political rallies on the basis of money. So therefore, only those parties, apart from few exceptions, by and large, only those parties which have a lot of money are able to give an impression to the voters that this party may win, because this party enjoys a lot of visibility. Now, to deal with this problem of spending too much money, a law was brought to put a limit on the spending of candidates. There is a limit of 95 lakhs or 1 crore for Lok Sabha candidates, etc. But firstly, that limit is not enforced, because people sometimes spend 50 crores on elections. They spend all the money in cash and the election commission is unable to catch them or unwilling to catch them. If they happen to be of the ruling party, election commission in the last few years, as we have seen, has become a puppet of the government. And they are unwilling, not wanting to catch people of the ruling party, even if they have spent 50 crores. However, they sometimes may be unable to catch them because they can't really get evidence of this person spending 50 crores because he has spent most of the money in cash and he declares in his election return that he has only spent 70 lakhs or whatever, 75 lakhs in his election. Now, this could have been controlled if the government had implemented notbandi for at least political parties and the candidates. That means they should have said, when the Prime Minister went for demonetization, he said that, look, I want a cashless society. Now, I can understand that ordinary people can't be cashless, but at least political parties and candidates can be made cashless. You just pass a one-line law, make one amendment to the Representation of People Act, which says it shall be a corrupt practice for a candidate to spend or take any money in cash. Period. That will be a corrupt practice for which they will be liable to be disqualified. Now, if you are caught even in one instance of spending any money in cash or taking any money in cash, you will be disqualified. If this law had been brought, it would have curbed this thing to a very large extent. Secondly, there is no limit on spending by a political party. Now, if the BJP puts up 500 candidates in the Lok Sabha, at most, all the candidates of the party put together can spend 500 crores. But the BJP in the last 5 years gathered 16,000 crores just by way of electoral bonds as well as other donations. Where is 500 crores and where is 16,000 crores? That means the party can spend 30 times of what the candidate can spend on the elections. There is no limit on the spending by political party, etc. So therefore, we have reduced what Anna Hazare said. We have reduced elections to a game of paise se satta or phir satta se paisa. After you get elected, you use your power to get more money, and this is what we have come to. Of course, to curb the influence of black money or curb the influence of money in elections, we can implement several other reforms in our electoral system. One of them is proportional representation. In proportional representation, if a party gets 2% vote only nationally, it will still get 2% people elected. That means 11 people will be elected to the Lok Sabha of that party, even if it gets 2% vote. Then I know that even if I am voting for a small party, if that's the party that I like, I am not wasting my vote. Then I will vote for the party that I really like, rather than in this first past the post, where I will feel that, look, this party is not going to win, I'll be wasting my vote. And therefore, I will vote for the less bad among the two parties who have some chance of winning. This is what is happening. So therefore, proportional representation, then state funding of elections. So there are many candidates or many parties who don't have any money, even not even 1 crore per candidate. So therefore, their candidate cannot even spend 10 lakhs, what to say, of 1 crore in the elections. Now, to get over that problem, a proposal was made that you have state funding of elections, which means that every candidate who contests the election, after the election is over, will get, let's say, 50 rupees per vote that he has received. So, if he gets 1 lakh vote, he gets 50 lakhs. If he has received 2 lakhs votes, he gets 1 crore. Now, this way, he can take loans from his friends, etc., friends and relatives before the election to contest the election, and then repay them after the elections by getting that money. Those who say that, no, no, this is too expensive, don't know what they are talking about. 50 rupees per vote only means there are only 60 crore votes which are cast in a general election. It means 3,000 crores, which is peanuts. 3,000 crores for the state to spend by way of state funding of elections is peanuts. And you can put a limit that people will not get more than 1 crore. That means if you've got more than 2 lakh votes, the maximum that you will get is that 1 crore, which means that you won't even spend 3,000 crores, you'll probably spend 1,500 crores. This is an easy thing to implement, but obviously those who are in power, they don't want to do this because they have all the advantage of power. BJP has 30 times as much money as the next political party, 30 times. Now, obviously BJP will not like to curb if they are in power, they will not like to curb the role of money power in elections, etc. And that is why these political reforms are not being implemented. Therefore, we need to have very, very clear, strong electoral reforms, strong judicial reforms, strong police reforms, if you want to curb this business of preventing criminals from getting elected, etc. Thank you. General Verma, I won't be able to stay till the questions because I have to go somewhere. There are people who are waiting in my office. Okay. So are the questions right now or will they be after some time?
Thank you so much for your very wide-ranging comments on. I think you've covered almost all the issues which are ailing our system, be it the money power or the muscle power or, you know, the system of voting, first past the post, etc. I just want to raise one question to you and to Dr. Qureshi. As per the 170th and the 244th Law Commission report, as also the J.S. Verma Committee report, they had recommended that at the stage of charges frame, a person should be disqualified. What are your views on that?
No, I told you what my views are. They are very clear. That would be dangerous because, see, the court has no option but to frame charges. The court cannot go into the correctness of the evidence which is produced by a police officer. If the police officer wants to frame an innocent person, then all that he has to do is to put the name of one witness in 161 statement saying that he saw this crime being committed. If it's a rape victim, the rape victim or somebody else who says, you know, I saw this person being raped. If it's a murder case, just one witness, 161 statement, maybe a false statement saying that I saw this person murdering. The court in such circumstances will have no option but to frame charges. And therefore, it will be easy for the ruling party who controls the police machinery to disqualify opposition candidates that they fear by just framing them in this way. And that is why this was not eventually accepted.
May I come in on this,
General? Please, bolia.
Yes, sir. Please, sir.
Mr. Prashant Bhushan has very correctly pointed out the risk involved in, you know, the framing of charges, because it is true that charges are framed by the police totally on the basis of the orders of the political masters. So there is no fairness. But judicially, I had conversation with some judges of the Supreme Court at different points in time. One very senior judge of the Supreme Court said that the framing of the charges, the judge can throw out the charges. And he said there are lots of cases which come in appeal that the charges have been framed wrongly and they go into appeal. Therefore, maybe theoretically, that is the case, that the framing of charges has to be with the application of some judicial mind. Many other people say that, as Prashant ji was saying, that it is almost automatic. Whatever police says, the court says, yes, these are the charges. So, but he knows better.
What I was saying was that it is true that the court has the option of throwing out the charges, but that is if the charges are absurd and not supported by any evidence. Suppose somebody says that, look, this person has committed this murder. He's charged, the charge sheet is filed for murder. And the only evidence that the police produces is that somebody said that, look, I saw him walking past this dead body. Then the court will say, look, this is no evidence to charge him or accuse him for murder. And therefore, he is discharged. But if the police is clever enough to say that some eyewitness is saying that I saw him shooting this man or whatever, then charges will have to be framed, because at that stage, the court cannot go into the correctness of the statement of this witness. That's what I was saying.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We'll take one or two questions because we've already overshot the time. Mr. Bhushan, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you
very much. Nandini, just one or two questions. Question for Mr. Reuben. What would the route look like for the judiciary to pass reform in the legislation? Who would enforce this? Would this process languish in the judiciary for years? This is from Mr. Srikanth Narayanan.
I think if the judiciary can just function on its, as far as its sanction strength is concerned, which Mr. Prashant Bhushan just alluded to, that in itself would make the criminal justice system much more faster, much more efficient. But having said that, as I said, that this is more of a political culture problem, and as we rightly discussed, this needs deeper electoral reforms, deeper political reforms, and deeper police reforms. So I think multiple things need to be done with regards to that. But more than anything else, it's about the political parties themselves essentially owning up.
Thank you, Ruben. Nandini, one more question, if there is any. No other question? Dr. Qureshi, final words, if you would like to say something.
No, I have nothing more to add, because you had a good range of speakers, and all of us put across different aspects of the same problem. And of course, I wish there was more public participation, but it doesn't matter. It is going to be on record. It will be available on YouTube. People can see these views. But at least discussion on the subject is important, and that is the important job which you are doing. Solution is not easy. There is it is very complex, as Prashant Bhushanji also pointed out. I don't know what is the solution. But one solution which at least Supreme Court tried to attempt about setting up special courts, as I requested, I am repeating and reiterating, kindly get that studied, or RCS, DS, or whosoever, and maybe consortium of 11 state, 12 state, exactly what has been the experience. Let us understand. Of course, Supreme Court has also asked it to be studied, but you can also do the study. What has been happening? It 2018 and 20, it's almost 7 years. So that at least that will give us some direction, some light for the future. Otherwise, thank you so much. It was very nice and very stimulating. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Qureshi, Dr. Reuben, Advocate Reuben, and Prashant Bhushanji, Kavita, and of course, Mr. Gogoi, who already left, and to all the participants and the viewers who are watching this and giving good comments. And because of shortage of time, we couldn't take up all the questions. For that, we are sorry. Thank you very much for being part of this discussion. Namaskar.